is Steve Marino hosting for James Gilliland. And as you wish, James is at a very important conference up in Montreal with the International Institute of Integral Human Sciences. And I spoke with him a couple days ago, and he was doing quite well. He had already given a three-hour presentation, which was well-received. Had hooked up with some major researchers up there. Dr. Hertog was one. And this is a very interesting organization up there. It's very cutting-edge in how it hooks into mainstream. It happens to be a non-governmental organization affiliated with the United Nations and seems to be staffed through its board by associates that are closely connected with the Catholic Church, with the whole idea centering around interreligious and intercultural understanding for world peace. It's quite a show, and I commend James for being invited to speak up there. He'll be up there through the remainder of the week. So what I'm going to bring your way tonight, folks, is a rather interesting show. I thought, due to the nature of where James is speaking at, it would be interesting to cover some very significant events that have occurred in my experience as an investigator that show a mystical paranormal connection to things that we're directly involved with of this nature. These events I'm going to speak of tonight are going to be shared with us by somebody who has experienced them directly with me, so that third-party point of view can give the reflection of perception of what they saw and experienced. This fellow is a very close friend of mine, and his name is Alan Wieblin. He's also the vice president of Psi Applications and has really assisted in many of our technical operations and investigations and moving our software forward, some of our technical issues with the Internet. And computers have been a real valuable resource for us. During that time, Alan assisted me in putting together a major documentary research project on James Gilliland's case file. Back in the beginning, it was previewed on Coast to Coast on March 9th of 2001 on Coast to Coast talk show. And we're going to speak with Alan here about what transpired just very shortly, like within a half hour before we went on the air to preview this documentation that we put together. It was 40 pages that unveiled previous research, a previous flap of activity, had scientific reports from a study that was ordered by Jalen Hynek. When Alan comes on here, we'll go ahead and launch into that. We all have had experiences in our time of synchronicity, so to speak, where we saw something ahead of time that might occur, and it did occur, or something would occur, and we could see that there was this connection it had with other events that were going on in our lives. And maybe then, several days later, other things would occur that were totally unconnected to the prime event, but yet we're really a big assisting to it, or you know, making the better part of that prime event happen. These sort of things, I'm sure a lot of us have experienced. We would consider almost mystical in nature. What we're going to share with you here tonight are events that had really strong evidence, such as video that was shot, physical impacts on the ground, that sort of thing, that also had a mystical connection with what was going on. So we're going to try and concentrate on the more predominant ones that had this type of evidence for those that are more of the nuts and bolts nature out there. Alan will be joining us here shortly. Alan, when you come on, just go ahead and speak up, because then I'll know you're there, okay? We also invite any speaker, anybody who would like to call in and ask questions. If you're listening, please feel free to do so. the way you'll hook in here, I think you just go ahead and chime in and let us know you're there, and we'll make it happen. Okay? So, Alan, are you with us? Okay, he's not with us yet. The one thing that's interesting about this one event that occurred on March 9th, 2001, is that it occurred right over the offices of Psi Applications, which really doesn't amount to much. It's a home office inside the home where I live. But for this thing to happen directly, like just about over the top of our house, was quite an astounding thing. I mean, I was basically up on the roof of the house with a camcorder in one hand and a 2,000 candle power spot beam in the other hand. And this was like, you know, 15 or 20 minutes before we were going on the air with Coast to Coast. So the other thing that's interesting about it is Alan had gone outside to take a break from this grueling research we were engaged in, putting all this material together and getting it loaded up onto the net for its preview that night. And he was taking a small break out there just looking at the stars. And this UFO event kind of seems connected with him. It started to transpire and occur, and he you know, initially discounted it as one of the jets from Travis Air Force Base or something, but when it began to display characteristics that were totally non-conventional in nature, he came in and got me. And of course, knowing I was close to going on the air there and everything, I was a little overwhelmed, and I thought he was joking me, but he was dead serious. And when I went out and saw it, it blew me away, knowing we only had 10 minutes left or 15 minutes left before going on the air. He says I was up there on the roof with this equipment and nothing flat. He couldn't believe how fast I was up there. So it was kind of funny, but we managed to kind of, you know, get the video and gather all that documentation and then jump back in there and go on the air, too, on top of it. So what I had done with the footage, though, was I had broken it up into a bitmap and had done some still frame enhancing. And what is clearly seen in this is a similar type craft like what you would liken to an Adamski saucer with pods that are viewable underneath it, but it's coming out at a 90 degree angle, and it seems to be almost coming out of this black pulsating light that fades to black and pulses back red. But in a momentary freeze frame, you can see where it's black. There's almost like a cookie-cutter clear space that is exactly the same as the saucer itself, like it popped out of this vortex or something. I mean, it looks like this craft that you can see actually would fit right into this area of this pulsation, and so we found that interesting. The non-conventional characteristics that this event displayed were basically you know, being motionless at one point when we flashed the spot beam at it. It began to do some morphing, and like it was responding to the flashing of that light, which we refer to as a CE5 response. Close encounter of the fifth kind is a human-initiated contact event. And it also began to morph and do pulsation sort of activity. We estimated it to be maybe about 2,000 feet 3,000 feet in height altitude at the most, and maybe not more than maybe a mile a line of sight from where we were located at. So we were able to get an estimate using calculations on its size, possible size and stuff. The other characteristics, of course, that were non-conventional was no noise, totally silent, and almost stealthy. Before it had come over to our location, it had done some other things that were quite unusual. And so this was very interesting because we kind of felt that the connection this event had was to the previewing of this research article, Beckoning Contact, which can be reviewed on our site, because it was substantial in securing the case of the UFO phenomenon activity occurring up there in Trout Lake, Washington. So, Alan, are you there with us yet? Hello, Alan. Well, he'll hook up here as soon as he gets him. So, The thing that happened after the end of this event was this craft slowly began to take off into the distance. And at that point, I realized I was running out of time and had to get off the roof and be prepared for this show. But it almost like it seemed like it was trying to imitate a plane, and it's because it began to blink a light and slowly just go, you know, off into the distance. And you know, from just your common eye, just looking at it, not knowing anything else about this event, you would assume that it was probably just a plane. But of course, we knew this to not be the case. When it came over our location here and became motionless, it was for a period of like about, I think, 3 or 4 minutes that it just stayed in one location and did its morphing and pulsing routine. It was pretty incredible. Some of the estimations we did on it, I think we came up with the craft potentially being like 50 feet in diameter. There's a formula that MUFON has for making a pretty good educated guess at what the size of a particular object might be. If you know the location of the object, possibly what it might be over, what its possible altitude is, given those proximities, you can use this formula they have that employs in its calculation the distance to the moon and the size of the moon. It's pretty extravagant. It's pretty amazing, actually. But it's based on the size of the object as compared to what would be considered a full moon, which is basically an aspirin held at arm's length. And from there, if you can have the other information, you can basically come up with a possible size of any particular object you may see. The hard part, of course, of taking a look at any light phenomena in the sky at night is to be able to really understand what perceptions are, you know, when you look in the sky. You see stars, you see the moon, but, you know, do we really think that the moon is, you know, so many thousands of miles away or the
Hello?
Star? Yes.
We're trying to get your guest on the line.
Okay.
And I apologize
no
for
problem.
This. We'll get him on here very shortly.
Okay, sounds great. Thank you. So, you know, you see these lights in the sky, and without having any kind of bearing, you could just as well guess that the moon might be, you know, 2,000 feet in the sky. It's really hard to get a gauge on it. So what we're able to compare with when we see luminous light activity that is seems to be, you know, non-conventional is we can compare it to what we have seen as conventional activity, aircraft, that sort of thing, that we know are within our atmosphere, not orbital. That's the big thing here, key issue, to determine if any phenomenon activity is orbital or if it's within our atmosphere. So the way we practice a lot of times, living here close to Travis Air Force Base, is with a scanner, we will actually see the jets coming in from a particular area, and we can hear them talking to the control tower about their bearing and their altitude.
They're online with you.
Okay, great. Hey, Alan, are you there?
Yes, I am here.
How's it going, Alan?
It's going great. How's everything going here?
Real good. I'm hopefully I'm not boring everybody. I'm just rambling on, waiting for you to come on. But I was just explaining to everybody about the March 9th, 2001 UFO event that occurred like 15 minutes, I guess it was, before we went on the air. You remember that, huh?
Yeah, I thought it was a little bit more before that. It seemed like an eternity from the time I was spun in the craft until I ran to the door and screamed your name. It just seemed like a lot longer. You know,
right.
Just kind of sat still for the time that we filmed that. It's quite something.
Right. Well, I'll tell you what. Let's go back to that moment in time that night when we were at the end, I think, of almost several week or 30-day research sprint where we were trying to put together all that material for the Beckoning Contact article.
I think we were shoulder to shoulder for about a month.
Man, it was tight. It was
yes.
tough. And that was the night we were actually previewing that publicly, I think.
Yes, exactly.
And so you stepped outside to take a break because we knew we had that talk show coming up, and I'm just going to let you explain exactly what you saw and what you experienced through the whole thing there. Just go ahead and...
Okay. Well, like you said, Steve and I were working on this project and very intensely for about 4 weeks, and we were at the end of it. And I stepped outside probably, I would say, a half an hour before, and the event actually showed itself 10 to 15 minutes after that. Anyway, in the middle of the street, like I normally do, I'm standing there just kind of looking up, and over the horizon there I see a something that's red. It's not blinking. It's coming straight at me. I didn't think anything of it, really. I just thought I was tired and been a couple of days. And so I didn't take my eyes off of it, and as it actually decreased its speed and turned to its right, would be my left. This craft was actually huge, and looking at it as, on a profile basis, it looked like red streaks, solid red streaks. I listened for the sound. There was no sound, no blinking lights, just red streaky, like a side of a building was painted with red stripes. It was very strange. In any case, it then it traveled that trajectory after it made its right turn, very, very slowly. At that point, when I decided it was something valid, I ran to Steve's front door. I said, "Grab the camera." Well, after I said that, before I made it back to the street, I really truly believe Steve was on his roof setting up that camera. Remember that, Steve?
Yeah, I do remember that.
And you can hear him setting up the camera in the footage we have on the site there. As it made its way in that same trajectory, Steve, this is the part I can't remember. Maybe you can help me. Did we actually throw the spotlight on that and then it stopped, or did it stop
right
before that?
No, it responded to the spotlight.
Exactly.
In fact, that's what was the most significant thing.
It actually turned and hovered at that point.
Yeah.
Now,
how long would you say it stayed motionless there while it was doing its morphing routine? I guess I shouldn't say motionless, but not traveling in a straight line. It was pretty much staying in one spot. But you know, explain what you experienced there while it was.
I think, once we did that and the craft stopped, you know, that's when the realization of this craft overcomes you, I had a quick flashback at that point, Steve. I probably never told you this, but 30 years I've been a believer and never really saw anything
right
up until 3/9,
right,
and it was quite an event for me, and
right,
I was watching intently,
right,
and listening and doing all the things you should be doing.
Yeah.
And at that point where it stopped and hovered, you know, that's when it was all real. I would say realistically probably a minute and a half, and maybe even 2 minutes.
Right.
It seemed like a lot more.
Right.
But that was quite a profound profound thing once it stopped there and hovered.
Yeah, and not only hovered, but what wasn't it doing some morphing routines?
Yeah, yes. There were several morphing routines it went through,
right,
and at the end of the event, really was when it showed its true colors, as far as morphing,
right?
Because it made itself look like something it didn't in the beginning,
right? Right.
Right in front of us.
Yeah, and you know, I have to say, Alan's done some great work on the footage we shot of that, which is available on our website. And the Haunt Link section, just go to the 3/9 sighting, and it'll take you straight to the page. On any of this stuff on our site, I just have to say as a footnote, I apologize for right now. Our site's going through some transitions and is in the process of being updated and revamped. I crashed my computer, so we have a whole new site that's going to be uploaded. But in the meantime, we have what's there, and most of the stuff is all still accessible. So that's just... little footnote there, but he's done some breakdowns on it with the footage, and we also have a great still image of when you can see this thing like coming out of the cookie cutter black hole space where it was pulsing from, and you see this craft. It's pretty well defined.
What was I don't know if you noticed too, Steve, but what was really something to look at is the stills that we have in the footage, you know, the two circle objects that are actually part of the craft,
uh-huh.
You know, someone really could mistake those for, you know, jet engines.
Right.
You know, off a fighter plane or something. But the,
right.
the dimensions and the size, the total size of the craft,
right.
And, you know, the absolutely no sound,
right.
And no blinking lights, all those things don't add up.
Well, yeah, also the fact that it was motionless for a period of time.
Exactly.
I don't know a jet fighter that can do that. Yeah.
Yes. And then, you know, after it being motionless there, you know, it turned and started moving again.
Right.
Now, you know, something with sound, we could validate, but this
sure.
had no sound and moved in
yeah.
such a gentle way.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say that definitely the unconventional characteristics on this one would be it remaining motionless for that period of time and doing its morphing routine, no sound. You know, these are things that a helicopter is the only conventional flying object we have that could stay still or motionless, but the noise it would make.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, what would you approximate that you thought the altitude of this thing was?
I would say between 2,000 and 4,000 feet.
Yeah, that's what I was saying too.
And that's, you know, that's playing it safe.
Yeah.
You know, that now that I think back, I should have paid more attention to that.
Well, it was your first sighting, man, you know.
But, you know, yeah, and the excitement and the exhilaration and
yeah.
the realism of it all was a lot to take in at that time.
Right, and, you know, we're speaking here of mystical connections, and we're speaking of an anomalous event here. What's the connection here with this event that's significant to you? I mean, did you think that it's transpiring right before us going on the air for this case file was significant? And connected to that, or was that just a coincidence? You know, coincidence?
Well, going on history with you and I,
mm-hmm.
It was a coincidence.
Yeah, it definitely.
It seems like whenever you know we get down to bones and we are producing something or you know really have our heart and soul in a
right.
project,
right.
that these things show themselves,
right,
and show themselves specifically,
right. Yeah, and this is interesting, a third-party point of view perception coming from Alan, even though he is VP of PSYOP and a close friend and has been a research assistant for some time. Something here that may be of interest to everybody listening is Alan is very discerning, and he's not overtly religious in nature. Maybe you could just share a little bit about your religious perceptions and, you know, maybe even if you might be agnostic, which is okay, but you're open to God in a higher form.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, the thing is, this might sound funny, but like a lot of us, I'm not all grown up yet, and I really don't know what I believe in. And it's hard to explain, but I just don't. If I did, it would be in my heart, and it would show
right.
through as that, but it doesn't.
Yeah, it's okay if you don't believe in God, you know, I mean,
I hate to say that
out,
word,
you know,
you know I don't know.
You know, what's interesting, though, is the fact that this is interesting from an investigative point of view, because your perceptions were not based on the hype of your own mind to feed into something that wasn't there. You're explaining basically that these things are occurring and some of the other things we're going to talk about here as well. And they seem connected to things. So it seems like there is a higher power or force that seems to know what's going on or is connected to this. But it's a direct perception from you and the experience, not, you know, based on what you're wishing could be the case.
Exactly.
Know?
Almost almost like a clean slate. And, you know, I wasn't really or hadn't been corrupted by anything on the outside to tell me anything else other than what I visually see and comprehend.
Right,
and,
right.
But the God issue is, I don't know, it's in Steve's teaching throughout the years and things many things I've learned from him and experienced with him, which Steve likes not to tell what he's seen or what he's experienced, because we are investigators, and you know, you don't like to tout your own whistle on these things. But the several sightings we have had have been connected, you know, with us, and have been very, very significant. And
right.
You know, I feel that we should have gone real public with it, because they were significant.
Right.
And they were life-changing in a lot of respects.
Right.
For me, anyway.
Yeah. You know, there's been a couple other events that have occurred. We'll just touch on lightly here.
Sure.
That happened here right at the PSYOP office location, and seemed to be happening in connection with some research we were doing at the time on the potential reality of chemtrails.
Right.
You know, why don't you go ahead and touch on
well,
that?
Well, the one that's this is another one that's pretty significant, and Steve has never really elaborated on this one, and kind of wants to dismiss it in a sense, but it was very significant. Again, Steve and I were at the office working intently, either on the site or a paper or a project, and again I stepped outside in the backyard this time. Which, if you're in the backyard, we're a stone's throw away from Travis Air Force Base, which could have had a lot to do with this sighting. But anyway, real quick, I looked up and saw a cloud formation that was tightly woven and seemed to be spinning, but in a stationary position, not moving, but rotating. And I looked at, you know, and I thought to myself, boy, that's really weird. I wonder what that is causing that. And so I called for Steve. I said, Steve, what do you think that is? It's just, you know, unstable air up there. And as Steve came out the back door and we were looking up, a silver, perfectly round craft, whatever you want to call it, came bursting through this cloud. Hovered there for probably maybe 2 seconds, maybe 3 seconds, and then headed off in a northerly direction at a very, very smooth travel speed, and I didn't take my eyes off it. Steve ran and got the camera, couldn't get the camera working. I told him to run and get the binoculars so I could get a closer look. At this point, I didn't close my eyes. My eyes were tearing because it had been so long I had kept them open, and I got the binoculars, put them up to my eyes, and by then it was out of sight.
Yeah, it was very, very small, but it was definitely there, and it almost seemed, my recollection, I remember that this cloud or stream of cloud we were looking at was similar to some of the stuff we were researching at the time, which would be,
right.
Could be considered by some people to be like a chemtrail.
And I don't know if you remember right at that time, Steve, when I went out in the backyard, you have the one tall tree back there that the birds make a lot of noise right there.
Right.
Well, when I was looking up and were we both looking up, and it came through the clouds. And this might be, I don't know, you know, a mind thing, but, you know, all the birds stopped chirping. There was no noise.
Huh.
That craft came through.
Yeah.
And then when I lost it line of sight and through the binoculars, all the noise came back. The ambient noise came back.
Wow.
It wasn't there when we were experiencing this.
Yeah, the thing that I found most incredible about that is, you know, I remain skeptical. I try to remain discerning. I wouldn't say skeptical on all this stuff. But
right.
I had heard a lot of stuff on the chemtrail thing. And, I mean, you know, there's a lot of conspiratorial rants that go on in the field, and you've got to be able to discern through them. But you also can't just dismiss things summarily. But, you know, the chemtrail thing was something that, you know, was a little bit controversial for me. But, you know, I was still examining the evidence. But one of the things that began to come up, I think, at that point in time was the fact that some people were talking about seeing craft in some of these chemtrails, whether they were there to dispense them or to get rid of them or reduce their harm. I don't know, but it seemed like we were kind of in that mode of research when this thing happened out in the yard, and it was really incredible because I was at a loss to explain why it happened or anything. But, again, the mystical connection on this was that it occurred while we were involved in this research at this point in time, and it just has to make one wonder what, you know, could be in effect that would know this and put something like this in action. You know, I mean, this has happened in several accounts. So it's pretty incredible because, I mean, you know, for lack of a better term, you'd have to think it is a very much higher, ominous presence that would be able to to know these things. Now, you know, I want to go ahead and take a jump start here forward in time, because I'm trying to think of the most significant events that had, you know, insurmountable evidence that, you know, was very definitive, and there being a paranormal event that was occurring connected to us in Psi Applications work. Most recently, in 2003, a lot of people may remember back in time there was a series of crop formations. Well, one main one that became world famous that occurred here in the San Francisco Bay Area. To be more specific, it transpired and occurred probably less than 5 miles as a crow flies right here from Psi Applications home office, and was referred to as the Rockville Circle. And by some reason, it achieved worldwide fame, and of course, it being within the quadrant of Psi Applications investigative sphere, I became the lead investigator on it, and I got to know for the first time really well many people within the crop circle community, which was just the finest group of people and investigators I've ever met. You know, I think there's a lot to be learned from them for those of us that are in other arenas of the paranormal field. They really are a fine group of people who pull their talents together, learn how to cooperate, and gather definitive scientific evidence to determine authenticity or hoax in crop formations. Because as we all know, there are the crop circle makers, but there is also definitive evidence that determines whether a crop formation is real or not. These are anomalous changes in the cell structures, all the way down to there being geometric equivalents in the formation that step beyond Euclidean geometry. Five new theorems in geometry were found to exist by the late mathematician Mr. Dr. Hawkins, and he found these quite by accident, investigating geometric significance of the rock formation over in Scotland, and he started to tie this in with the crop circle. So he developed these five new theorems that were really amazing. It was even debated within the mathematical community and the mainstream scientific community. Well, it ends up that all five of these theorems existed within the Rockville formation, but several other scientific factors, such as node elongation, which is the joints of the wheat stalks, where there is authentic phenomena activity, similar to as if a microwave energy had elongated and deformed these nodes. Also, seed vigor, where the seeds from these wheat stalks that were inside the formation would grow at twice the rate and twice the speed of those out in the control area. These are things that hoaxers could never duplicate, even though they might be able to duplicate the design. And for anybody who knows, there were three boys that stepped forward and claimed later on into this investigation that they had made this formation. And their parents were so adamant that this was so that they even had a press conference with the main reporter that was covering this up in Vacaville, who was at odds with our investigation and was almost like trying to debunk everything we were doing. She didn't invite us to the press conference. In fact, we were decoyed by them to not even know about this press conference that was going on, so we wouldn't be there. But the boys who claimed this actually claimed they had a diagram that their mom found in her pants and everything, and but we never saw the diagram. We pursued to try and have a conversation with these boys and to interview them, because we were really interested to know, because there is a phenomenon that occurs with this crop circle maker thing that many crop circle makers have stepped forward recently and said how the phenomenon actually begins to transpire and interacts with them, even though they think they're hoaxing a formation. So that's a whole other advent there, but we really doubted that was the case here. But when we, toward the end of the six-month investigation, we had a scientific team. Dr. Gene Auburn, who's a consultant with aerospace and stuff, did the geometric analysis, and he found all five of these new theorems to exist within the geometry of Rockville Formation. All the node elongation and seed vigor tests were done by Dr. Levengood, well-known throughout the scientific community. I became a fast friend of Dr. Levengood's when he notified me at the very end of our investigation that he had all this additional information we didn't even know was developing on the side. So the enigma of these kids stepping forward, and they avoided us, you know, like the plague, still to this day. We just never could figure out how it is or why they would have stepped forward and claimed responsibility for that formation. But now what happened during this investigation was another small formation was found about 3 or 4 miles due east, I believe, of this formation. It was a little panhandle type formation. And we focused our concentration on that because nobody knew about it, so we were able to have privacy there, because by that point in time, I think there was major mobs trampling down the Rockville Formation, and so we were practicing all these protocols as we were being guided by major researchers in the field like Nancy Talbot and you know, Dr. Levengood and such via you know, cell phone. We had Ruben Iodorete, who's Northern California MUFON director and a well-known crop circle researcher. He was directly involved in our research team. And so we were gathering a lot of evidence there. We were pretty tired after about 2 weeks into this whole foray, which was through August and July of 2003, when I was joking with some of my associates, Alan and Ruben and such. Can you imagine, I said, if we found a formation that big, you know, as big as Rockville Circle, in 8-foot-high corn, because it would be incredible, because instead of looking at millimeter-thick wheat stalks, you'd be able to look at, like, you know, several, you know, 2-inch-thick corn stalks, and you'd see, you know, these major effects in much larger size. And, well, Alan, I'm going to let you take it from there and explain what happened about a day or two after my joke to that effect.
I think... Steve, if I'm not correct, were we in Vacaville doing a job?
Well, actually, I think Anne, my wife had called me while we were over there at Rockville and told me, get ready, you know, there's a small formation that was on the Vacaville Reporter, another one, and then I had said, you know, because Ruben was out in the field, I said, let me see if I can just pass this off to Ruben. We were laughing about that, and we thought that Ruben was going to go look at it, and we just kind of dismissed it, and then we were taking off to go get materials for a job that we do in our construction business, because we were so diverted and we were like way behind on some stuff we need to take care of, and we forgot about an estimate we need to do. So as we got up into Vacaville, we thought we better double back to the office and take care of that estimate, and that's when we stopped at the gas station there, and then take it away.
Stopped at the gas station, and in the newspaper stand there was three standard newspaper stands that you put coins in, get your newspaper out of. One paper left, and the front page of that paper had the corn field crop formation.
Yeah, this was it. Just
and,
happened
and
to be
the way Steve pulled the truck in or the car in, and we pulled up to the. If you can imagine this, pulled up into the store there. And on my side, on the right-hand side of the vehicle, I could reach out and touch the newspaper bin. And when I was looking at it, we were both looking at it, and there was like one paper left, and here it is with the picture of the crop circle.
Right. We didn't have any idea that it was in corn or anything. We just heard from my wife that supposedly there was a picture on the front page of the Vacaville Reporter about another formation. It was just a small one. That's all we heard, but... Was this a small formation in the image you saw, Alan?
It was really a cutaway view. It showed the whole crop circle, but you really couldn't get a good perspective of size. But it was jaw dropping at the very least because of what we had been talking about and what we were doing, what we were thinking about. So I don't quite remember. What did we do after that?
Well, the thing that was so incredible about it was the fact that my jaw dropped when I saw the picture on the paper, and I asked them to grab it, and because this was not a small formation. In fact, in the image of the formation, you can see it was from, I don't know, maybe about 1,500, 2,000 feet up in the air, a small plane. You could see the row of houses that outlined the edge of the field there was like maybe it's a block or two of houses, and so you could get a gauge on just how huge this formation was, which was in the middle of this cornfield. And it wasn't just this. What is even more incredible about this is this was what's referred to in Suriology as an insectoid formation. It had a series of concentric circles from large to small, six of them, and two that jutted out from the top, the largest one, like antennae. It looked like a larvae, for lack of a better explanation. This entire scenario with the Solano circles here in California of 2003 can be seen on solanocircles.com. That's S-O-L-A-N-O circles.com, all lowercase. You'll see everything there. This formation just kind of blew me away because he knew and I knew that we had joked about this, and here this huge formation is in the middle of this cornfield. So, you know, as he was reading it, I was trying to figure out where this was located. And what did you find out where it was located at, Alan?
Right off of Leisure Town Road.
Yeah, about not too far from where we were sitting at, like a block or two, huh?
Yeah, probably 2 miles from Highway 80.
Yeah.
On the right-hand side, it's incredible. I'm just looking at the photo here, and it was exactly from head to tail. It was ten house a block.
Right.
That's how big this thing was.
Yeah.
Quite incredible. And you still don't get the scope of it. And obviously, you don't see it from the roadside because it's a fully developed a corn field,
right,
and 7 to 8 foot stalks.
Right.
So, you know, our first trip out there was quite extraordinary.
Yeah, we have that on video, and we haven't uploaded that yet, but it was pretty interesting. I think we went back to the office, and I guess we never made it to the estimate. We gave that up, but we loaded up some gear, and I think our objective was to get out there and see what was out there before the sun went down, right?
Yes.
And,
We instantly went into high gear and got back to the office, got the equipment, and went right back out there.
Yeah, and it was like going through the jungles of Vietnam. I think we had to walk like probably what it was like about a 7 minute walk through the cornfield.
Oh yeah, through a pollen laden field, you know,
right,
in 100 degree heat.
Yeah.
It just was quite something. And when you hit the first portion of this formation, the biggest circle, the first thing that I noticed were the stalks and the way they were bent over, and at the offshoots or the strings to the next, the stalks were actually cut in the circles. They were bent over, and the first thing Steve noticed was the fact that the material was gone. Anything that was cut all the corn stalks were gone. There was no debris. Everything was cleanly. It was like someone came in and cleaned it all up and hauled it off.
Right.
But as you can see plainly from the aerial view, there are no trails to it from it. Just like any formation that you see.
Yeah, this to me was a much more significant formation than Rockville, but because some of the crop circle researchers from the Suriology community had already been involved in the crop circle forays here in Solano County, we met Michael Miley. First time I met Mike, we knew of each other, and we ran into him, and boy, the pollen had torn him up. Boy, he sent us a picture, I think, a day or two later, and it looked like he had been in a barroom brawl or something. His eyes were all swollen and everything, but it was a good associate. Mike became a part of our team, actually, a very important part, and he developed our press releases. Some things that happened here is we're kind of running toward the end of the hour here, but we did something very significant in this formation. We did the first ever live telecast, a live broadcast utilizing our laptop and a cell phone as a modem and our Sony Cam. We did a live telecom broadcast to scientists back east, Dr. Lutzow and Jeff Wilson, two major researchers within the crop circle community, who were able to receive live images and conduct a serious scientific investigation, guiding us what to do as we went through the entire formation. Several conclusive things were brought out by that, including documenting about a 40% missing mass component, and several other anomalies. This is all detailed in a great article that Jeff Wilson did about this on the SolanoCircles.com website. The other thing that I want to mention here is all of this investigation that was done on the Solano Circles, which is detailed on that site, all was brought to a point in December of that year when we did something that was unprecedented. I thought, well, let's just bring this thing all the way into mainstream, because there was so much controversy and publicity about this that was in the mainstream. I thought we'd take advantage of this because we had significant scientific evidence that was developed by a scientist on our scientific team, not myself as an investigator, but with SIOP leading the scientific team. So the group of us had held a national press conference in which we had major news presentation from ABC, NBC, and it was on all the major venues on TV, and was previewed, this press conference, which announced the anomalous factors that were found. Most of it centered on the Rockville Circle, because we only had so long, but there were significant things on the Solano Circles, Rockville Circle, I should say, the one that everybody knew about, such as what Dr. Gene Aubrin had developed, including that the diatonic ratios that came out of the geometric theorems, he developed actually into a series of notes that he played on a keyboard. And this is, you know, the odds of this just randomly occurring, or if these boys actually hoaxed the circle, of these things happening just randomly in sequence with that, are so astronomical, it just didn't happen, you know. And plus, we presented evidence that we had witnesses that lived right across the street and were outside in the middle of the night and didn't see anybody out there hoaxing this formation, which they would have, because they could hear a pin drop out there, but the boys never knew that part of things. So,
one witness, Chuck Marino.
Yeah.
You know, the
no relation to me.
Exactly. What he saw out there, during that that window of time, it was quite extraordinary.
Right. Yeah, initially he said he saw what he likened to a motorcycle headlight out there, and he couldn't figure out why that was out there, but he was trying to get in the house. They were going to watch a movie, and later on that evening, I think about 1 or so, they stepped out to take a cigarette break, the kids, and from the movie, and they were looking across the field trying to figure out what it was they saw earlier, so they were intently looking over there.
Right.
But that left a window of time that somebody could have hoaxed the Rockville formation of only, I think, from 1 to 6, so like 5 hours. Because,
5 hours.
And there's no way if you, I did a breakdown as just an interesting matter of study of an MIT formation that was done by some students. They tried to duplicate the anomalous effects that are found to scientifically exist in authentic formations. And anyhow, the man-hours they had with the amount of people, I came up with a man-hour, per man-hour calculated rate it would take to do a formation. And there's no way that these three inexperienced boys would have been able to even come close to doing this formation in this reduced time rate that these MIT students, you know, actually did a hoax formation. So there's a whole series of factors there. You know, I think the mystical connection now with these three formations, because I'm thinking all along, what does this all have to do with anything? Why are these things happening right around our location? I felt that the phenomenon began to seem connected to us when I had joked about there being a crop circle formation in 8-foot-high corn, because not only did it occur, but it was the record-breaking formation, the biggest, longest one, and the only insectoid one in the entire world that ever has occurred in 8-foot-high maize, which is corn. These formations broke all these records in so many ways. It's just incredible. But the funny thing about it is I came later, you know, the press conference was successful, and that we brought this into mainstream. We earned a little bit of credibility there, which I was able to talk to some of these reporters about other things that were involved with, such as Project Contact. And so basically the upside of this whole thing, and I believe what the connection is here, is why did this happen what did it do for us is it set the stage for us to be able to really hold or call a press conference in the future when we have Project Contact firmly in gear and have documentary evidence of a confirmed visitation that is from advanced intelligences that seem to be non-human, and that this can be duplicated and can occur again with the cooperation of this group, that we'll be able to actually hold a press conference and be taken seriously, a mainstream press conference, to announce this. Whereas I don't think without these crop formations, which is a little more hands-on that people are entertained by, if that hadn't happened and we held a press conference on that, we wouldn't be able to just do this, you know. Anything else you want to add about that experience, Alan?
No, I'd just like to add real quick, all in all, throughout these years, with you, Steve, and in getting this as being an outsider and learning from you, I truly believe they're out there. But I also believe that we, as the people and the UFO community, it needs to come together, and we need to all put our minds together to set a precedence and to bring forth a sighting globally that we can all view and actually experience this. I think until then, we're not going to get that unless everybody believes and everybody is in on it, except for a chosen few. The UFO community, when I was brought into this by Steve, from an outside view, was very fractioned. And I think until we all work as one, it's not going to happen. With Steve's vision and psi applications, it can happen, and I think we all need to stop and think about that.
Well, what do you think, just quickly, Alan, about the two sides of view of potential extraterrestrial visitation of either being benevolent or malevolent, and what about the case files that we're involved in with Project Contact? Can you share a little bit on that?
Well, Steve, I like to play devil's advocate, and if you say yay, I say nay, only to pick your brain and to become more knowledgeable.
That's what makes it good.
That's just the only way. That's a tough question. We need another show for that, I think.
Good answer.
Thank you.
I think you'll make a good politician, too.
Don't say that.
One thing is I have made our focus with the contactees that we've dealt with over time and all the cases that we look into primarily making the focus toward what seems to be demonstrated as a benevolent connection. My opinion is if you want to know what exists anywhere within the universe, you don't have to really travel through space or be able to leave the planet to tell, because you have a prototype right here that's been tested and demonstrated can't exist anywhere because it exists here. And it's called look out your front window, because what you see there is what can exist anywhere given the same conditions exist. There's only one variable that may exist that's a little bit out of our control and perspective. And really we can put that into perspective too, because if you look historically back in time, we have a recorded history, so you can see advanced intelligences with not much more than a stone wheel or a sword, no electricity. But as through time, we are where we're at now with technology. So we know that any life form could exist similar to that anywhere in the universe given the same circumstances exist. Probably many places. The one thing we have to be speculative on, though, is what if our species survived the threshold we're at now and went maybe 2,000 more years to 5,000 more years in the future? We can speculate what that might bring about and changes what it would be like, and you can begin then to conceptualize what the UFO phenomenon may really represent, which is a little more realistic than something that would be unperceivable or beyond our grip, because it is really just another life form that has advanced, that much. So, here in our world, we have what you might refer to as good and evil. Even within our own species, we fight amongst ourselves. There's so much mayhem, death, and destruction threatening the world. So I would have to say that, yes, benevolence and malevolence may exist anywhere within the universe. It's the dichotomy. So visitation could exist from both sides, negative and positive. And unfortunately, from my research, I believe that there's a little bit of the negative aspect of things that's involved with the visitation that's occurred with our referred to as satellite government. Outside of the U.S. and the allied sphere, I see a very positive contingent still occurring in many cases, but only one or two case files really that I know of where there is active current activity that is definitely positive and benevolent in nature, and that is really what we focused on. We say we can, you know, say that this is benevolent because we're looking at a track record going back of 30 years with nothing negative having occurred, plus the fact that they're willing to just leave us alone to our own demise if need be if we don't acknowledge them with a positive light. It's called the directive of the non-interference. You can't be more benevolent than that because they will not impose themselves upon us. But if we should acknowledge their existence and demonstrate a desire to want to know more in a positive vein, they will interact with us. This is my understanding from the contact that's occurred with those who do have touched bases with these beings. So that's about it, I think, that I can share with you on that. With there being so much negativity in the field of ufology, we thought it'd be wise to just go ahead and concentrate on what might be positive or benevolent just for the sake of a little bit of counterbalancing, you know. And then, of course, I always have my good friend and research associate, Alan Wieblin, to keep me straight and be the devil's advocate. Right, Alan?
So, I will always be here, man. Oh, boy. Thanks for having me, Steve.
Yeah,
really.
I want to thank you for coming on board there, Alan.
Absolutely.
And, I hope you continue to do all your good work with us. And thanks for being on.
Thanks, Steve.
And I think I'm going to be out of time here, so I'm going to go ahead and say that this is Steve Marino co-hosting for James Gilland, and may he be doing well and be back soon here with us next week from his conference in Montreal. And this is Steve Marino signing out for James Gilland on As You Wish. Thank you. Be well.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning in to our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.